When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eye, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind, then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Welcome to WNHH-FM 103.5. I'm your host, Justin Farmer, inviting you to be in community with us, with people making a difference. Today, our guest is Amy Jo Hutchinson, an anti-poverty organizer and advocate. So glad to be in community with you, Amy.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here. I'm excited. Thank you.
I'm excited on so many levels. I remember the famous speech, and I'm sure at this point it's just like, I've been doing stuff way before this speech. I've been in community doing all these things, but everybody, you know, interacts with that famous speech back in 2020.
Wow. Yeah, in February, right before COVID.
Wow, I remember seeing the clip from Now This. So you have this amazing speech where you're in front of Congress, and you know, you're talking about the fact that many of these elected officials, you know, are making $144,000, and there's a cap for Medicare, right, and access to all these important things that allow people to function and live. And I think the cap was at, what, like 30-something thousand or 44,000 something minuscule, and so you lay down the law, and so it's so it's such an honor to have you. So, you know, when did you become an anti-poverty organizer and advocate? When did that become your ethos?
I think I became I have your intro song stuck in my head. That's such a nice song. And I'm sorry. I just keep hearing it in my head and I want to dance. I think I became an anti-poverty advocate probably without knowing it. I have two daughters, and they were in elementary school and a Title I school, right? Low income neighborhood, high need. And it happened because they were going to tear the swimming pool down in the school. We're the only elementary school in the state still to this day that has a pool. But I was like, you know what? This isn't fair, right? Like, they're coming in here, they're making these changes that they wouldn't make in schools in other districts. And so I think I became an anti-poverty advocate years before I knew that being an anti-poverty advocate was even a thing, you know, which I think happens to a lot of organizers, right? Like, you just become embedded in your community. And, you know, community is the center and the heart of it. You know, my heart was being broken for what was being taken away from those kids because people who didn't live in that community didn't realize or understand the importance of that swimming pool to our kids. Right. And I think that's what did it. My heart was just broken and I was just tired of sitting around and watching all these decisions being made. And so, I told someone the other day, I was like, I was just mad as hell. Right. Because they were coming and taking these things away from our kids. And, you know, something as trivial seeming as a swimming pool. But really, in our neighborhood, this pool in the summer, the city pool was the only thing we really had access to, you know. And so I'm like, this is an integral part of the kids' lives here. And so I just started speaking up, and I was a Head Start teacher. for a few years, and I went to a Ruby Payne training, Bridges to Poverty. And as I sat there, I was like, oh my gosh, is that why I do this? Is that why I react this way? You know, it was amazing. I laughed for that training. I cried in that training. Like, so many things were just brought to the surface for me. And then I think that's pretty much the beginnings for me.
I often think about, you know, the future and what it could possibly look like. And so as a mom, in this time organizing, you know, what concerns do you have? What concerns do you have for your children, in terms of the state of the world, and what things are you hopeful about?
You know, I have two daughters. You know, I have two daughters. First and foremost, I'm very concerned for them because they're females. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we're seeing back, you know, women's reproductive rights and just their bodily autonomy and healthcare, right? Because to me, these are healthcare issues for women, and I'm very concerned for that for my daughters. That's just one of the many things. You know, I mean, we live in a state here where Our poverty rate continues to grow.
Y'all are,
I think we were the only state in the nation, actually, whose poverty level continued to rise. And so that bothers me. One reason is because I'm a lifetime West Virginian. I've never lived anywhere else. I love it here. You know, I love the people. I love the landscape. I love everything about it. I'm very proud of being an Appalachian. But then, you know, now I'm faced with, I can't blame my daughters if they don't want to stay here. You know, we also have we're losing population faster than any other state in the nation too. And to me, that's why, you know, that speaks to just the environment here politically. And I struggle with that a lot. I'm like, I want y'all to stay because I know we have such a love for this place. But on the other hand, I can't ask you to stay, you know? So yeah, it's just a real awkward, uncomfortable position for me to be in, I think.
And what gives you hope about the work that you're doing and hope for the next generation?
Yeah, I mean, I try to tell, I'm in my 50s now. And so I'm constantly telling young people, I'm like, it's y'all's turn. Like, we're getting tired, you know? But I do think that we have made huge strides in empowering people and helping them realize, like, you know, you can speak up. We do belong in these systems that we're taught that we don't belong inside of. You know, when someone is elected to a government position, they're elected to represent all of their constituents, not just a very small percentage of that. And so it's those things, you know, I'm very hopeful about that. I think my daughter's generation seem to be much more in tune and more aware. I'm sure it has to do with the technology piece, right? They have instant access. But I, like, my oldest daughter just turned 20 the other day, and she couldn't wait to cast her vote for the first time when she was 18, you know? And so, like, there's a lot of energy in her friend group for voting and just becoming aware and making educated votes and educated decisions. And so I'm very, I'm inspired by them, and I'm very hopeful. And from that aspect of it, you know, they do seem to be just more aware. Some of those barriers, like, I was raised, you didn't get into politics, you didn't talk politics, you know. I think women are really starting to step up and say, hey, you know what? Equal means equal, right? And so that leaves me very hopeful for my daughters and their friends.
And so what is the campaigns that you're currently working on?
Right now, childcare is my biggest one, but I'm very concerned about the care infrastructure. So, and myself included, right, I've heard it referred to as the sandwich generation, where we're raising our children, we're raising our families, but we're also taking care of our elderly loved ones. And so, you know, we don't have protections here like paid leave, you know, again, maternal health in West Virginia and the nation. But childcare right now is one of the biggest ones. I see childcare. We have a huge lack of childcare here in West Virginia. I believe it's like 61% of West Virginians live in a childcare desert. And then, you know, is it really rocket science as to figure out why we have one of the lowest workforce participation rates in the nation? You know, we can't work if we don't have someone to provide quality care for our kiddos. And so that's really, that's the big one right now for me.
And so what, you know, what things, policies do you think need to be moved forward? I heard you talk about, you know, maternity leave, but you also mentioned how you're the sandwich generation. So like things like paid family leave, is that one of the things that you're advocating on, moving on?
Yes, we hope to really start building that out. Right now, one of the things that I'm doing as an organizer is we're in the process of organizing listening sessions. So, you know, we can really hear from West Virginia moms, like, what is it exactly that's making it so hard for us to raise our families and become self-sustaining? So we're going to roll those out sometime in the spring, sometime later on in the spring, across the state, and just try to hear from West Virginia families, like, what exactly are our biggest barriers? And then what can we do to make sure that those are addressed?
What, you know, to a larger audience, you know, what is the messaging and the message that you want people to know about West Virginia, right? Because we usually talk about states in red, blue, and we usually talk about states, you know, in a geographical region, right? North, south, east, west. And so, you know, I know West Virginia in the sense of it being close to D.C., but in many ways, it seems like a completely different planet, right? Like the policies, the things that people talk about. And so I'm always struck by Joe Manchin represents these people and they're just down the street. And how is it? So what would you tell people, right? Especially being in Connecticut, what would you tell people, you know, about West Virginia that you feel the narrative of West Virginia is often gotten wrong?
You know, I think one narrative that upsets a lot of us very quickly is this narrative that we're really uneducated, lazy people, you know, whereas that couldn't be any further from the truth, right? I don't know if you'll ever find a state that's full of hardworking people like West Virginia. But again, it's just the policies get in the way of keeping us from being able to rise up, right? Like to elevate our family situations. And first of all, come and visit us, because I believe National Geographic just listed us as like one of the top eight, I believe, places in the world to come and visit, you know, like especially if you're an outdoors person. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful here. It's all four seasons. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And you'll have a different experience depending on which time of the year you come. So that would be my first thing, is come and see what we're about. You know, we welcome you. We just, the newest national park was just named in West Virginia, you know, but also our history, right? Like the mine wars and just, you know, we separated. I always tell people, I'm like, West Virginia was literally born out of the resistance, right? Because we wanted to separate from the South. And where that took place is right down the road from me here, you know, right downtown, where you can go into the actual courthouse and you can sit at the desk, you know, where the judge's bench, I guess, you know, where those decisions were made for West Virginia to secede. And I'm like, we just have so much rich history here of just people pulling together and taking care of themselves and pushing back on things that were harmful, you know, to us as a community. And I think those are the parts of West Virginia. I think it was, and you'll have to check me on this, but I believe it was John F. Kennedy, JFK, who came here, and you know, when he was running for office, and he was like, the sun doesn't always shine in West Virginia, but the people do. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know if there has ever been a statement that I've related to, and it's just really like that just warms me, you know, to know someone was here, someone saw us, right, and someone understood it. And so I think that's just come and visit us, check us out, and see what we're about. Don't pay so much attention to the negative headlines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the chance to visit Harper's Ferry a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, it is a place of resistance, right? It's always been mm-hmm. a place of resistance. And the people are wonderful. The people are hard workers, and humble, right?
I
didn't see too many boisterous people. I just saw people trying to go about their lives, do the best that they could.
With what they had, right? Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Why do you feel there's a disconnect in Washington and in governance from what the people want and need and what our officials often provide?
You know, we hear a lot of talk about the system is broken. And one thing that it was just laid out for me very blatantly when I started organizing was the system's not broken, right? It's designed to operate this way. So I think we need, I like to remind folks, I'm like, hey, listen, the way the system was designed was to uphold white men's power, right? So they could keep what they had. And so, like, we need to just start talking about that, I think. But we're also, whenever you're in a marginalized community, and I consider myself, my experience with poverty, right, as part of a marginalized community. But we're also taught that we don't belong inside those systems, like the government, like, we're not smart enough, or we don't look the right way, or we don't know enough, right? We just don't have enough wisdom or knowledge to go and speak to the issues and the policy changes that are necessary to correct them. And so I think that's one of the hardest parts is we're just so used to, we're just so used to like pushing through and, doing what we have to do to survive out here. And so we don't pay attention to that stuff because we're just so detached from it, right? From the government and the policy work and all that stuff. And we're tired. We have a lot going on, And so it's easy for us just to not pay attention. Like our legislative session just ended. Our state government spent so much time just trying to like manufacture fear. There was very little progress made for the state, and I'm like, what do we have to do to get people to pay attention to that? And I think sometimes it's hard to kind of elevate these stories and to reach everybody, because politics isn't usually the most exciting thing that you can look, you can scroll and read through if you only have a few minutes a day to scroll and read, So I think that's part of it. We've just been conditioned to believe that we don't belong, that we can't be change makers. And I think that's one of the biggest things, like everybody has a story, and the more we elevate this, the more, we talk to and with marginalized communities instead of about or at them. I think that once people realize we do have a place in there, we can tell our stories. It's valuable. We're the experts, right? We're the experts of our lived experiences. And I think sometimes it's just we need to talk more about things so people even have a chance to empathize, if that makes sense. You can't even understand or begin to want to empathize with an issue that you don't even know exists. Does that make sense?
No, that definitely makes sense. I was talking with someone here locally who works with labor unions, Kate Sullivan. We were talking about story. And so how did you find, your story, and how do you tell your story? Has that changed over time?
Yeah, I think one of the, I was talking to someone who was actually on staff in the Capitol when I did my speech, and she said, you were like the unicorn witness, right? Because not only did you have your own lived experience, but you organize and you collect stories. So I could bring all of these stories into the room with me. but I do believe that everyone has their story. I don't think I shared mine until I met an organizer. It was kind of new here. I'd never heard of grassroots. I was like 40. I was probably 40 years old, actually. I'd never heard of any of this stuff. And then she was just saying things that, like, I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's me. Like, that applies to me. I can do this. And so then, just what do I need to say to make people understand? I'm pretty relational, but West Virginians are very, I think we're kind of lyrical, right? And we love to talk and we love to tell stories. But as far as constructing my story, I can remember being, even that video, the testimony, like my hands are folded because I was terrified and I couldn't get my hands to stop shaking. So the only thing I could do was to sit with my fingers together because I didn't know how else to stop the shaking, right? Because it is scary, and it's to ask people to put themselves in front of folks who are so detached from their lived experience, who don't understand. Many who have been on the record publicly for years from, you know, positions of power and authority, saying that they don't like me simply because of where I fall on the poverty guideline scale, you know, to ask someone to stand in front of those people and just put their, like, their biggest vulnerabilities in front of them on the desk. I think that's like hero status. I really do, you know, and I'm like, I don't think we give enough time or attention to what it really does take for folks to be so vulnerable, especially when they're speaking to people in power, because it's a lot and it's scary. Like, I think I was 42 years old roundabout the first time I even said out loud to anyone that I was living in poverty. You know, I mean, you have all of that fear and just the anxiety of speaking in front of people, but then you also have the embarrassment and the shame of being poor, right? That society puts on you. And so I think if we could just teach people how to stand in their power and turn their pain into power, and that's going to be done. Policies are changed because of stories, right? Not because of statistics, really. I mean, it has a little bit to do with it, but if we can start replacing some of those statistics with human faces and human experiences, I think that's the best way for us to approach any of this change-making stuff.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I often think about, you know, a lot of people, especially in marginalized communities, shy away from telling their truth. And so as you were talking, I was just thinking, you know, poverty is apparent in West Virginia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, there's a concern about sharing your truth that many of the people you work with, many of the people around you, share in that experience. And so, you know, well, why do you feel it took you so long to share this truth about yourself? And then once you shared that truth, what did it take away from you?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. First of all, to the first part of that, I think why it took me so long because I didn't know people wanted to hear it. Mm. Right? Like, I mean, I had never, like I said, when I met this grassroots organizer, it was actually for Our Children, Our Future, which was the first nonprofit, the first place to organize for. But when I heard her talking about this, like, we're going to push for policies that end child poverty. I'm like, is that how that works? And I mean, I'm pretty educated, right? But again, it was just a system that I'd never been invited inside of, the whole political realm and policy and procedures. And so I think that the first part of that was that I never knew anyone was looking to hear my story. Because I didn't realize that I did have a place in any of this work. And I think the second part of that, man, repeat the second part of that question again, because that was a good one and I want to make sure I get it.
I guess what was taken away, right, from sharing your truth? Like, did the sting of, you know, sharing that you are in poverty, was that removed? Did people see you in a different light? Was there, you know, like, what were the things that were demystified by telling this truth?
I don't know if any of it was demystified, to be honest with you. I'll give you an example. So I was invited once here in town to participate in a panel about hunger.
You were on a panel about hunger.
Wherever I went. And we freeze up there for a second, I think. Did you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I looked at my oldest one. She just started her freshman year at the local high school, which was like 1,300 kids roundabout approximately. And And I said to her, I'm like, hey, you ready to go? Like, I want to go up, you know, to the soup kitchen. We're going to do this panel. And she's like, I don't want to go. And I said, what do you mean you don't want to go? And she's like, I don't want to go, Mom. She said, the news is going to be there, is what she said. And she's like, they're going to talk to you because they always want to talk to you. And she said, for once in my life, no one knows I'm the poor kid. And like, I can't explain to you, like, that took the air out of my lungs when she said that to me. And that was probably the moment where I realized, oh man, you know, I wasn't just telling my story. I was telling my family's story. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't take away the sting. I think a lot of times, like when my video went viral, which was completely unexpected, right? There wasn't even press in the room when that happened. Like, for what, you know, my spirituality, like, it was just destined to happen is the way I believe that. But when that went viral, one of my daughter's friends, they'd been friends for so long, and he came to school and he's like, oh, listen, my mom told me I needed to be nice to you now because you're poor. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, is this really, parents are really saying this crap to their kids about, you know, about my kids? And so I dealt with a lot of that. I'm very funny about certain things because I do try to build a wall around my girls because the world is not kind, right? But I don't know if the sting will ever be taken out of it because people think the worst things about poor folks, right? I mean, they think that it's because of something you did. Like, you created this financial problem for yourself, right? By making poor decisions. And I don't know if it'll ever get easier. I mean, it's kind of gotten easier for me because I do it so often. But after I say it, and when I go home or when I'm in the car driving home from an event, I still, all of that stuff just come, you know, is someone going to make a meme out of me? Or, you know, just like, because I'm just waiting for someone to be like, oh, you lived your life in poverty because you just didn't do something the way you should have. Right. So I think that will always be there. Yeah. But I will say also, part of what's happened is that other people have been empowered to tell their story too, you know? So that's a huge plus. And for me, it was worth it, right? Just letting folks know, hey, you know, we don't have to, like, this doesn't have to be a deficit, right? Like, we can go stand in our truth, as uncomfortable as that is for us and for the people we're sharing our truth with. And we really can be change makers, I believe. You know, so I think the part, if anything, that took the sting away was the fact that other people, so many other people, have been inspired to get involved in organizing work and sharing their own stories too.
No, that's beautiful. It's funny because poverty is subjective, right? I've grown up poor, but compared to my family that grew up in Jamaica, right, I'm the only American born. And so when I hear them talk about poverty versus the poverty that we are in, it's very subjective. I'm like, oh, I guess we're doing fine. But then when you look at these policymakers who, you know, to the point you made, it's like, you have health care. Your family has health care, right? You make a decent wage. And somehow the policies and things that, you know, are enacted on just don't make sense for the rest of us who are working and trying our best. You know, as we come towards the end of our time, you know, how can people connect to the work that you're working on? And, you know, what if you had the one word of wisdom, right, that you could impart on people, what would it be about, you know, organizing and telling story?
One thing is relationship, mm-hmm. right? Like, we have to become in relationship with one another, mm-hmm. you know, so we care about one another, if for no other reason, right? So there is that. And I'm also going to say that no matter where you live, you know, you may or may not live in West Virginia, but wherever you are, somewhere there is an organization that is waiting for you to sign up, right? Either for their email list or to attend an event to get to know folks and to get to know the issues that they're working on and organizing around. Someone is waiting for you to just like take that step to get involved, you know, and I know it is scary and I know that it's intimidating. But one thing that I also know is that I've had the honor of working with very few people who have not returned and have not stepped up their advocacy work after becoming involved, right? After they took that first step and just started to learn about what was going on around them. You know, now they're just like, their leadership development is like through the roof, you know? And so that's someone out there is wanting your help, right? They need your voice on whatever the issue is. So I always tell people, like, I can talk to you all day about the issues, but the issue that breaks your heart, the one thing that you cannot tolerate one moment longer without opening your mouth to speak up against it, that's going to be the issue that you're able to move mountains on. You know, that's going to be what gets you out of your chair, out from behind your screen and into a community meeting somewhere, you know. And so I think it's just pay attention to what's going on around you and who's doing the work that you want to be involved in, you know, as far as change making, and just sign up, you know. We need you. We need you out here. Like, that's the, you know, because I believe a lot of people were like, when are you going to run for office? When are you going to run for office? I believe that the power is out here. I think I have far more power out here than I would sitting under the Golden Dome, right? At least for now, at this point in my life. So, but I'm like, if we could just, you know, if we could all sign up and then bring two friends, like, I think that's how we're going to get things back to where we want them, however that is, whatever that looks like, right? But we need folks out here joining the causes.
I agree with everything you said, except for we waiting for you to run for office.
I keep telling my people, let me get my kids grown, right? Like, let me get that part over with, and then we'll see. We'll see what happens. But yeah, I do believe the power is out here. You know, I think, I mean, that's why, like, in my work, it's more common, you know, someone has an issue, they have time in front of a lawmaker, and they're like, hey, we need people with lived experience. You know, and I think that as we move forward, we're realizing, you know, we move forward while looking backward, but like, no movement in history has ever been won without a grassroots movement behind it, right? Without grassroots involvement. And so I'm like, we need that. We've been shown this over and over again throughout our history, you know, especially here in West Virginia, right? Like, we know what the power of organizing does. And so I just think that we need to work harder on having these conversations with our friends, with people, people in our book club or whatever, right? But like, what do we need to do to find allies in this work? And then how do we get them involved? And it could be something as simple as, I don't know, filling out postcards one night or inviting four or five friends to a restaurant somewhere to just have a conversation, right? Or to invite them over to your house to have a conversation, eat pizza, talk about what's going on around you. You know, like, it doesn't have to be something fancy. It can truly just be a one-on-one conversation with people that you already do life with. And I think that's what we need to do. We just need to lean back into each other.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It is a real treat to be in community with you. My favorite question that I always get to ask people is, you know, as we close our time, what's a song that we can remember you by, right?
This is kind of funny because when you told me to kind of think about this, I was like, oh man, I don't know. Like, I wanted to be something cool and, you know, like young and hip, but I'm not. I'm not young and hip anymore. So I asked my daughter, and she was like, this is going to be funny. It's me and Bobby McGee, right? The way Janis Joplin performed it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I used to sing. That's what I used to do. I used to sing in a couple of groups, and that actually was the song that everyone remembered that I sang, and people still talk to me about it. So my daughter's like, me and my Bobby McGee, me and Bobby McGee. So that's the song. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Right. So that's the one.
Powerful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for being in community, fam. Let us continue to plant the seeds of change so we can grow.
Amen. Amen. Thank you for this. Just these spaces, right? What you're doing is so important. I mean, just to help people understand, you know, who's available, who's out here talking about this stuff, you know, just to be able to make those connections. Like, this is so important, what you're doing. So thank you.
Yes. So y'all, so time to plane leaving? All right. See you at the airport.
I'm leaving on the next plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me like to wait for me. Hold me like you know I'll never go. Even though you know I will, I'm a traveling man. Moving through places, space and time. Got a lot of things I got to do. God willing, I'm coming back to you. Baby boo, I'm a traveling man. Moving through places, space and time. Got a lot of things I got to do. God willing, I'm coming back to you. Baby boo, I'm leaving. Go ahead and leave the call. Heard around the world from the wise of MCs. He's got to pay him more than half a pound. I'm going back and snatch it down. I got to stay, but we could probably run a back attack. Scenarios like this is dead. Turkish.